canonical description of GR, which of course we need to have a look at a little bit before we set to quantize it. I pointed out that in order to go to the Hamiltonian formulation, of course, you have to introduce conjugate momentum variables. And for that, you're always implicitly referring to a notion of time. And although there is no kind of distinguished notion of time, not in the, in the context of GR, you have to make some choice, and you can regard that as, you know, part of some kinematic background structure we have to make in order to go ahead. And I told you that what one always works with is a structure where one just takes one global well-defined notion of time that defines a nice slicing for you of the entire metric Lorentzian spacetime into a sequence of spatial hypersurfaces. And we saw that an adapted set of coordinates are where you, these are, of course, these are the ones that are adapted to the covariant formulation, but those that are now adapted to the canonical one consist of a spatial positive definite Riemannian metric, Hij, and some other data I identified for you that you have to kind of fix in order to come to a one-to-one correspondence. So kind of the real geometric 3D data are now encoded in this Hij. So we are kind of well on our way to the canonical theory, where we, of course, we have to identify configuration variable and their associated canonically conjugate momentum fields. And these I had also already introduced. First, we had to talk briefly about the extrinsic curvatures. So the extrinsic curvatures are, of course, well, in a way, they're the natural velocities, so in the Lagrangian formalism, so just Hij a dot, essentially. And the conjugate momenta associated with these Hijs were also very closely related. They're, well, almost identical to these extrinsic curvatures. Now, having defined the momenta as I did last time, we can then simply do the Legendre transformation. Just the reason why I'm not doing some of these calculations explicitly is that they're just algebraically involved, and we simply don't have the time here for doing them. Now, then you obtain what I would call the action in canonical form. In canonical form, that is Hamiltonian form, S equal to, now since we are performing a so-called 3 plus 1 splitting by the introduction of this foliation, let me also accordingly kind of split the four-dimensional space-time integral into a dt and a d3x. And now what one finds are the little pijs. So these were exactly the conjugate momenta of the hijs times hij dot minus n curly h perp minus n I curly h I. So this is what one finds, and you see it has the expected form. So your the field variables on your three-dimensional slices is the dynamical variables as well as these hij. So they appear now here in the form pq dot. And therefore, you know that whatever you're subtracting here is the Hamiltonian, or this is a Hamiltonian density, but I integrate over d3x. Of course, this is a field theory. Then this is my Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian, capital H. I'm just writing explicitly the functional dependence on these n's and ni's. Of course, these are just the lapse and the shift of yesterday's discussion. This is a three-dimensional integral over the three slices, which are called capital sigma, and n h perp plus n h I. Now, of course, I have to tell you what these functions are. Of course, they depend on the variables, on the momenta and the configuration variables. So let me put them down here on the blackboard. Hi is equal to minus 2 capital Dj pi I j of x. So reminder, this was the covariant derivative of the three metric H. And here is just one momentum with one index up, one down. And H perp, so this has one free spatial index. So there are three of these. And there's one H perp. And this has the following form. This is this kappa squared. This is essentially just 16 pi gn abbreviation I introduced yesterday. Now we have an object, which I'm explaining in a second, with four indices, curly g, ijkl. And then I have a term quadratic in the momenta, pi ij, pi kl, and a term that doesn't depend on time derivatives. Square root of h. H is the determinant of the spatial metric h. And here we have the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. OK, so this is, again, of the form we already looked yesterday at a similar expression. So this is kind of a kinetic term depending quadratically on the momenta. And this this just contains at most spatial derivatives. Now, let me define this gijkl for you. It is the following algebraic expression of the metric H. Various, so it's bilinear in the H's with various permutations of these four indices. So we start off by hik hjl plus hjk hil minus hij hkl. Of course, not unlike, you know, remember expressions for that appeared when we looked at the propagator and linearized gravity. So it's also kind of easy to memorize because it's always the one you're subtracting is the one that has the indices exactly kind of in the order, you know, that appear here. OK, now what is this? You see, this appears, this means now various contractions of these of this term pi squared. Yeah. So what this actually is, it defines a metric for you. So and as a matter of fact, it defines a metric on the space of three metrics. Well, why is that? Of course, we have this, so the space of three metrics. Of course, it's a function space. Right. So one point is a configuration hij. Now, what does the metric do? It takes two tangent vectors and maps them onto a number. And what's a tangent vector? Well, the tangent vector essentially is just a pi, right? So it's like this is a momentum here, appropriately normalized. So an object, right, that takes kind of two vectors, kind of contracts them in some way to spit out a number for you. That's a metric. But it's a metric on this functional space. And it has a name. So this is called the De Witt metric or De Witt supermetric. super metric. Of course, this has absolutely nothing to do with supersymmetry, but I mean, back in the old days, predating any kind of ideas of supersymmetry, supergravity, the space of all metrics is also something was called the superspace. So some kind of meta level. So this is a metric on the space of all Riemannian three metrics. Okay. Now, and to make the discussion complete, let me just write down the non-vanishing Poisson brackets that now appear here. So elementary Poisson brackets. So the first one is of these variables n. Oh, sorry, should give them an argument x. These are all field variables, of course, now. And I'm evaluating them at equal times, x naught equal to y naught. That gives me a delta mu nu on the right-hand side and a three-dimensional delta function. And similarly, the variables hij obey non-vanishing commutators just with their associated conjugate momenta, the pi, kls. Ah, sorry, I'm forgetting to write the argument. Hij of x, pi, kl of y, again at equal times. And I get also delta functions on the right-hand side, but of course I have to see they have to be compatible with the symmetric index structure, so which we also have already seen in previous calculations. So you get on the right-hand side kind of a symmetrized thing, delta ik, delta jl plus delta il, delta jk. Three-dimensional delta function of x and y. And by definition here, these delta functions that appear on the right-hand side, I mean, they're densitized. So when I integrate over them, I don't have to. There are no extra factors of square root of h as it appears. So the calculation rules are exactly like for delta function on flat space. Okay, now we have a whole array of algebraic relations. Now what can be remarked about this structure? Now, first of all, you see how these variables, the laps and the shift, how they appear. They only appear in the action in the Hamiltonian as these overall multiplying functions here. So they do not appear, as you see, in either the HIs or the H perp here. And of course, what the signals, and of course, in particular, no derivatives of them appear here, and also no time derivatives appear here. So they're absolutely not dynamical variables, but they have the role of Lagrangian multipliers here. Of course, now what happens when I make a variation? Well, I close my eyes, and I don't look at what they do in this action. I just derive equations of motion from varying this action. Of course, what I get is simply a dl by dn, and that should vanish, right, just by the equations of motion. And then similar for the ni. And what I immediately then derive are two constraints that require that this vanishes and that vanishes. Okay, so that just from variation of this action in this form, we obtain So, first remark is here. N and Ni are Lagrange multipliers. And varying them, sorry, I squeeze this in, I get four conditions in total. Well, per spacetime point, so H perp has to vanish. And these three HIs also have to vanish. So these are just constraints. On phase space, right? So they depend in some way on the pi's and the h's. So they depend quadratically here on the pi's and linearly here on the pi's, and well, non-polynomially on the configuration fields hij. Now these have names. These are, of course, well, turn out to essentially govern the dynamics of classical GR, these constraints in the canonical formulation. So this one is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And this one is called the diffeomorphism constraint or momentum constraint. So H perp, or rather it's vanishing. This is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And the three other conditions, they're called either diffeomorphism constraints or sometimes also called momentum constraints. And the reason for why they're called this, we see in a second. Now, so one thing to note, therefore, is a kind of, at first, bizarre a seemingly bizarre property. So this, I claim, was the Hamiltonian. So this is what generates the dynamics here in this field theory. Now, however, we said, certainly for solutions of the theory, these two constraints have to be satisfied. I mean, so these terms vanish. So therefore, my Hamiltonian actually vanishes on physical configurations. So that's the conclusion I can draw from that. And that's a well-known property of systems that are, as one says, reparameterization invariant. So here in GR, it's tied in with the fact that you have diffeomorphism symmetry somewhere in this thing. But it's a property you can also exhibit in much simpler systems, you know, like a particle system. So if you have a particle like moving, you know, x of t, and if you then kind of by hand introduce an additional new parameter along trajectories, and you just call it, you just put it out of hand, you just call it tau, right? And then you express everything parametrically, the x as a function of tau and the t as a function of tau, then one says, well, one has parameterized the system. And if one then kind of does this a similar analysis a la Dirac of performing then a Legendre transform. And then one, of course, since one has introduced another degree of freedom in the theory, one finds a constraint. And in particular, one then finds expressed, the dynamics expressed in terms of a Hamiltonian that vanishes on classical configurations, on solutions. So that's, yeah, so that's a well-known, it's a well-known property in principle. So it's not so surprising it appears also here. And of course, it doesn't mean that this doesn't generate a non-trivial evolution, because classically, you're taking Poisson brackets with this object. And just that it numerically happens to have the value 0, it doesn't mean that it doesn't generate flows. And of course, it does on the constrained surface. And that's, of course, similar to what we've seen in these toy examples of the, you know, the first class systems yesterday, you know, where both, well, the Hamiltonian wasn't there required to vanish, but the constraints themselves were, of course, required to vanish. But nevertheless, they would generate on the constraint surface non-trivial motions along the gauge orbits. And now here we see an example, if you like, where the dynamics and the gauge orbits kind of fall on top of each other in a way. So that's this peculiar feature of classical GR. Now, of course, the crucial question is, does that fit in with our discussion of first-class constraint systems? And in order to answer that, of course, I have to look at, now, I've told you I've got four constraints. I have to look at their Poisson bracket algebra. And if we can show that these things commute on the constraint surface, then we know we are dealing with a first-class constraint system. And of course, it will turn out that, yeah, that this is the case. Now, so what is the Poisson algebra of these things? Now, that is a slightly non-trivial calculation. And I'm still contemplating whether I'll let you calculate part of that, which is not too painful. Let's see. Now, whenever, well, these are always equal time Poisson brackets, but you know, occasionally I will just not write this just for sloppiness. Now, this is now a commutator of a diffeomorphism constraint with another diffeomorphism constraint with two different space-time arguments, apart from the coinciding time, of course. Now, this turns out to be Hj partial derivative I, where the derivative acts on the y of the following delta function, xy, plus another term, hi of y, del j x, three-dimensional delta function, xy. Let me write down the relations and then discuss them in more detail. So the commutator of a diffeomorphism constraint and a Hamiltonian constraint, h perp, is a Hamiltonian constraint derivative of delta function xy. And lastly, the commutator of two Hamiltonian constraints, the Poisson bracket, I should say, arguments x and y is the following, hij of x, hi of x, del y j on three-dimensional delta function, again, minus hij of y, curly hi of y, del j x, three-dimensional delta function. Okay, so this monster is called the Dirac algebra. And there is a slightly more suggestive way of writing it, which comes from kind of smearing these functions out. And that's actually also a good idea when you attempt to do these Poisson bracket calculations yourself. Because then it's not, you're bound to make less mistakes, kind of Poisson commuting things that involve delta functions and derivatives of delta functions. So they're less singular in a way. So the smeared out version, of this Dirac algebra, I'm just giving you for reference also. So what does the smearing consist in? So I'm not writing, well, I could write, you know, I could write the perp still here. So this is, there are now no free arguments. So you're always integrating things over spatial slices against, well, something you can think of as a test function. Of course, it also has a dual, it has the interpretation as a lapse also, but just think of it as a scalar function. Over, so just to kind of absorb this local index I, xi, and similarly, curly h of ni is three-dimensional integral ni of x, hi of x. So again, this is just, for our purpose, just an arbitrary kind of external, if you like, vector field that just smears out this expression. And as I said, so then the explicit form of this algebra becomes, looks much less singular and also is slightly more transparent to understand in its geometrical meaning. So what does it look like? So I start again with a commutator of two momentum, smeared out momentum constraints. H, I might need all of this space. So let me start here. Curly H associated with some vector field Ni, Poisson bracket of this smeared out object with kind of argument Mi in here. Now, what does that give? It gives an object of the same kind for argument ki, where, let me just adopt the three-dimensional vector notation. So vector field k is just the commutator of the two vector fields n and m. And that's actually the same as taking the lead derivative of m in the direction of n. OK, so that's the first one of the relations. And the other two look like this. A smeared out momentum constraint with argument ni, Poisson bracket with a Hamiltonian constraint smeared out along by scalar function n gives a Hamiltonian constraint with argument m, where now also m, of course, depends on these arguments n at ni. Ni del I n, which is the same as the derivative of the scalar function n in the direction of the vector field n. And lastly, two smeared out Hamiltonian constraints, h perp of m, give h of ki, so that's a momentum constraint where the ki is given by hij n partial derivative j on m minus m partial derivative j on n. So as I said, the nice thing about this is that, so this is now no longer singular, so no delta function, derivatives of delta functions appear. Now, there are various things to note here. First of all, the way to read this equation, this relation, really is that, first of all, you see, you note that the diffeomorphism constraints form a closed subalgebra of the entire Dirac algebra, right? Because the momentum with momentum gives something that's, again, a momentum. And what appears here, see, what the argument here is just the commutator of the two vector fields along which, well, you took these momentum constraints in the first place. And, well, what is this the algebra of? What is this the Lie algebra of? It's a Lie algebra of three-dimensional, of spatial diffeomorphisms. So what are the generators of three-dimensional diffeomorphisms? Well, the three-dimensional vector fields, right? So actually, what we see presented here is an algebra that is isomorphic to the Lie algebra of three-dimensional diffeomorphisms on the slices. So if you like, certainly a piece we've recovered from the full 4D kind of diffeomorphism invariance is that if I now look at these spatial slices of my foliation, then I see, aha, there is actually, well, these objects, they generate for me arbitrary diffeomorphisms within these slices. And that leads to this subalgebra of constraints. OK, so far, so good. It's not so surprising. So that was remark number one. So this star relation. What it has said is actually isomorphic with the relation for the Lie algebra of the three-dimensional diffeomorphisms. And of course, these are contained in the larger group of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. However, what this Dirac algebra is not, it's not isomorphic to the Lie algebra of four-dimensional space-time diffeomorphisms. It's simply not. So these are not the relations of the analog here of this object in four dimensions. Now, how come? Well, of course, what we effectively have done is we have introduced this auxiliary structure. And essentially, we have kind of projected this 4D algebra, slightly hand-wavingly speaking, along the spatial slices and kind of along the normal to the slices. And what comes out is not a version of the four-dimensional diffeo algebra, but instead this Dirac algebra. So there is a kind of a crucial difference in form, if you like, which now appears after the 3 plus 1 decomposition in comparison with what we had in the covariant formalism. And again, just to reiterate a remark I made before, it shows you that the 4D diffeomorphism invariance is not manifest now in this picture, not too surprisingly, because we've broken it very explicitly by introducing this preferred foliation. Again, it doesn't mean it's not there. Of course, it's hidden in the way these objects commute with each other. So it's encoded somehow in there. But the way it looks explicitly is rather different from the full four-dimensional diffeomorphism algebra. So that's, therefore, my remark number two. So the Dirac algebra is not isomorphic to the Lie algebra. Of the diffeomorphism of my entire space time manifold. And what you note, actually, it's not even a Lie algebra. And why is this? Well, this we said was a Lie algebra. Now, if I can draw your attention to this last Poisson bracket relation, it seems to say, OK, a Hamiltonian with a other Hamiltonian constraint gives me a diffeomorphism constraint. So why does that not present a Lie algebra relation? Why? Well, because the argument here has not just the dependence on the N and the M, which appeared here on the left, these smearing outfits, but it also has a dependence, now I should get out my red chalk, on one of the configuration variables. So this is not a Lie algebra relation, because this is a structure function and not a structure constant, right? As you would require if this was generally a Lie algebra. So this is a structure function. So it definitely is not a Lie algebra. So
we did all this for unequal time functors. Is everything just equal to zero?
No. Well, it doesn't.
Because like when you define your h at the top over here, right?
Yeah, you could say that. You could say that. These are all, of course, implicit. I mean, they're all equal time.
Yeah, so if we did this for non-equal time, so we can just do it. What does it think of it?
Well, I don't know, because my Poisson relations are only defined for equal times. So you're not. You're not allowed to ask that question. So that is all. These are all equal time relations. That's really inherent in this in the setup. One reason I already mentioned that in passing, why in the quantum theory everything will now focus very much on these constraints is because they really kind of capture all the essence of the dynamics of the theory. You know, because you could say, okay, now you know we know about what happens with these constraints, but of course there must also be equations of motion which I have to solve. Right? Just the Einstein equations somehow, well, how they must appear in some way here in the canonical way of doing things. Now, the reason why one doesn't, especially when it comes to the quantum theory, one doesn't need to deal with those, is the following little theorem that says, so if you take a Lorentzian space-time, so a pair of a manifold M, and a space-time metric, and if it is true that these four constraints are satisfied on every one of the spatial hypersurfaces, then the original GMU can be shown to satisfy all the Einstein equations. So it's a solution of the classical theory. So then GMU satisfies all 10 Einstein equations. So I'm writing them with this notation G menu for the Einstein tensor, which I trust you're familiar with. So this really captures what I said earlier. So the dynamics really is taken care of if I can make sure that everything, these constraints are everywhere satisfied. Now, of course, one thing, this is not a Lie algebra, but nevertheless, it's a first-class constrained algebra, right? Which, of course, didn't require us to have structure constants on the right-hand side. For that, we just needed that the right-hand sides are expressible as linear combinations of constraints, which makes sure that these Poisson bracket relations vanish weakly, namely on the constraint surface where all these h's by definition are zero. Yeah.
Just wondering, because I've seen this approach done previously with differential equations. You know, you take the Einstein equations and you Fourier the space, and you've got like four constraint equations and six dynamical equations, and you follow this one.
Yes.
This seems to be kind of an algebraic equivalent to that.
Yes, it is. So the four constraint equations are essentially the G naught naught and the G naught I equations. And the other ones are the real dynamical equations, so the capital V IJs. Yeah. So this is obviously equivalent, but you still have to do a slightly non-trivial translation when you do the Legendre transformation and see, you know, what kind of constraints appear in the Legendre on the Lagrangian side of doing things. Then things look like this, and well, here in the canonical way, this is what they look like. But this is exactly as you're saying, that is equivalent. Now, you see, in terms of counting degrees of freedom, remember what we did when we were looking at perturbative gravity. So what can we say now? Now that I've explained to you a few things about how to kind of subtract degrees of freedom when you have first class constraints around. So we are starting off with the variables or the canonically contributed variable pairs on spatial slices. So these were exactly the H IJs, P IJs. And these are, of course, both symmetric. So these are 6 times, well, as one always says, infinity cubed degrees of freedom. Well, one for each spatial point. Okay. And 6, so one pair of that you call a degree of freedom. Of course, it's kind of 12 variables in total. Now, we have 4 first-class constraints. And I told you, well, for each one strikes twice. So for each of them, we have to subtract from the dimension of space, phase space, we have to subtract 2. So, well, we have 4 constraints, so we have 4 pairs. So the H's and the H perps. But each one actually, so they're worth 4 pairs of 8 variables. So these were 12 variables, these were 8 variables. And of course, what is then left over are the 2 physical variables, which we already have identified as being the correct counting for perturbative gravity when we were looking at gravitational waves. So so this comes out kind of consistently also in this non-perturbative setting here. Okay, so it's obvious, the interpretation of these momentum constraints is fairly obvious from the algebra they satisfy. So they just turn out to be the infinitesimal generators of diffeomorphisms in the spatial directions. So now you can ask, aha, now what about this Hamiltonian constraint? Well, it turns out on shell, that is, when the equations of motion are satisfied, to correspond to deformations of these embedding surfaces perpendicular to itself. So in a way, of course, it generates a motion, it infinitesimally transforms you in the time direction. So from this point of view, it has a little bit of a special status, because of course also time evolution moves you along in the time direction. But you wouldn't usually consider that as gauge. So this is just to give you kind of a first glimpse of this issue that people call the problem of time. So it's not immediately clear, well, whether you want to always think of that as gauge degree of freedom, or whether this is actually kind of true physical evolution. If you treat it, if you kind of blindly close your eye and say, OK, let me just treat this as gauge, then you can do this in principle. But then you'll find that everything you call just an observable will be an equation of motion. So everything, you get a completely frozen formalism, which you can work with to some extent, but it doesn't relate in a neat way to physical situations one wants to analyze, where you have some kind of time when you're interested in evolution with respect to that time. And how to extract a notion of time from solutions to h perp equal to zero, that's a whole long story. So about which I'm not going to say very much today, just kind of to alert you that interpretationally, it's a little subtle, to say now, to say what the role of this kind of gauge transformations, in inverted commas, along the time direction versus a time evolution. Of course, this also appears in the Hamiltonian, right, there, of course, and it does generally give you also contribute to the time evolution of your dynamical variables. So how to think of that? Okay, now. Now we know a lot of things about, I expect you in a brief space of time, about the canonical formulation of gravity. But of course, our aim is to quantize things. Now, how do we quantize things? Well, we've spoken about quantization in general, about canonical quantization. Now we briefly have to talk about canonical quantization in the presence of gauge symmetries, or equivalently, constraints. How do you handle constraints in the quantization? And that raises some fundamental issues of how are you going to do that in principle. So let me just explain why. So our objective is, to quantize a constraint system, but of course, GR in particular. So let me draw the following little diagram. So I'm starting out from my classically formulated theory before I'm imposing any constraints. So I have some phase space, classical phase space, and some Hamiltonian on this. But I'm not considering constraints that might exist in that theory. So I call this the unreduced theory. So before I have solved for the physical degrees of freedom. Okay. So now one option is kind of to quantize that theory, then I'd arrive at a quantized, unreduced theory. But what I could also have done is I could have here already performed the reduction to the physical degrees of freedom. So this could be, as we saw last time, what one calls the symplectic reduction, right, where from S going through this constraint surface, by going then through equivalence classes, you arrive at a physical phase space. So that's one example of kind of what I would call a classical reduction. So you get rid of the gauge degrees of freedom at the classical level. So let me call this classical reduction. And then you get to the classical reduced, I could also call it the physical theory. Now, of course, I could then just take this and quantize that theory. Quantization. Quantization. And I'd arrive at a reduced quantum theory. Well, of course, hopefully, well, I could also try and think of how to implement, if I have quantized the unreduced system, of how to implement kind of some kind of reduction procedures to get to the physical quantum degrees of freedom at this level. Right? So then that would be some quantum reduction. Where I still have to say what this is supposed to mean. Right. Also to arrive at a reduced quantum theory. Now, a priori, there is no specific reason of why this should be a commutative diagram. So why these two ways, distinct ways of doing it, would lead to the same or equivalent theories. Now, of course, what one has to keep in mind, as we have already seen, we don't really know what is meant by these quantization errors, because as you've already seen, there is nothing like, you know, a unique, well-defined quantization once you give me a classical system. So. Now, why do I say these are potentially inequivalent? Well, they, of course, they treat the constraints themselves in a different way. So if I start here, if I kind of close my eyes to the presence of constraints here and just quantize this theory, then, of course, I'm also quantizing the gauge degrees of freedom. Right? And so there can still be kind of, if you like, quantum effects related to that, which are completely absent when I kind of exactly reduce the theory already classically. Then kind of no quantum fluctuations can happen with respect to the degrees of freedom I've thrown away. They're just gone. I've exactly solved for them. Right? So one can really imagine, well, that these are two inequivalent ways of doing things. And say if I had a So what it relates to clearly, in part, is what is the physical status of the constraint? So is it, as happens, I think, we could say in GR, that I'm just starting from a formalism which I know is overcomplete. So there is really, well, maybe little, there is no physics kind of by definition in this overcounting where I can relate things by diffeomorphisms. Then you'd say, well, really, ideally what I'd like to do is this here. I want to throw all of these out. I don't want any quantum effects associated with my, you know, this relatively arbitrary overcompleteness that I had to have in my initial theory. However, if you had a system where you say, let's say I have a particle system, and I'm confining by some mechanism the particle to lie in a subspace, say, of configuration space, and that would also induce kind of a subspace of your phase space, then you might be interested in kind of the effects, the quantum effects, or you might be interested in describing a situation where there is some non-vanishing probability in the quantum theory that your particle would actually not be exactly confined to the surface, so it would be kind of fuzzy. Right? And then you'd say, aha, probably this way of doing things is the appropriate one. So I don't think there's any general kind of black and white rule to say what to apply when, but it clearly some physics has to go into this. Now, another example from field theory one could think of where these things are really explicitly inequivalent is, now, let's imagine you have an algebra of constraints, first class constraints, classically, so that closes on itself. Now, going this way, what might happen is that this algebra picks up for what says an anomaly. An anomaly is just some extra term that pops up when you do quantum commutators, and that destroys your original algebraic structure. And typically, this will mean that your degree of, well, the technical terms, then it can happen that your first class constraints get converted to second class constraints. And for those, the degree of freedom quantity is different. So actually, they get rid of fewer degrees of freedom. So going this way, if you had such an anomaly present, and that can happen, would be intrinsically inequivalent, even just in mere counting of degrees of freedom from going the other way. Okay, so this is really, it is a relevant issue, so, and one that you should keep in mind. Now, in practical terms, why is going this way usually difficult or impossible? Because doing the classical reduction, you find a reduced space, say phase space, if we were in the Hamiltonian formulation, that is nonlinear. So even you started out here with some, let's say, r to the 2n, or in the field theory, some infinite, you know, dimensional analog of that, once you've imposed the constraints, you find that you're actually sitting on a nonlinear subspace of your original phase space. And in most cases, you simply don't know how to quantize it. You just don't know. You know, in quantum mechanics, of course, as long as we are sitting on an Rn, we can always resort to the Schrödinger quantization, since there's an essentially unique representation of the Heisenberg algebra of the Qs and the Ps and unity. But when you're in a more complicated situation, you generally you don't know what to do here. That's also true. So it is also true for a classical GR, certainly in a continuum formulation. So kind of reducing out, you know, what's inherent in this constraint structure already classically is very difficult. So certainly in four dimensions. Now, there's an interesting counterexample when you look at GR or the toy model analogous to GR in 2+1 dimensions. Again, in sufficiently simple cases, if you just look at the pure gravity theory, if you set the cosmological constant to zero, it just so happens that the reduced phase space is a linear space, and essentially you know how to quantize it. So then, well, that is kind of the more straightforward way of doing things. But in general, and as I said, in four dimensions in particular, very often one is forced to take this route. So that leads us then to the next question of what, how do you implement this? And that will bring us to the notion of Dirac quantization. And I think I'll leave that for next Monday. Thanks.